libraries are located on campus, there are generally about 3 times as many graduate students per faculty member when compared to user groups without on-campus facilities. This is a problem that can be alleviated in many ways, providing funds for user groups to go elsewhere, providing instrumentation money, etc. But one of the important elements is to locate major facilities on campus whenever and wherever possible. Now, Michigan State enters into a new era for heavy iron nuclear science research. And the NSF strongly endorses the outstanding traditions that have been established here at Michigan State. We look forward to many exciting results in the years ahead. And our congratulations and best wishes extend to you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcel. Our next speaker is Mr. James Dunn, Honorable James Dunn, Jim Dunn, the U.S. House of Representatives, who's going to extend the congressional welcome for the cyclotron. Jim?
Dr. Blosser first asked me to be here tonight and be on the stage. Of course, I was grateful to accept, but I really didn't understand my role until the president of the university was talking, and then it suddenly came to me. He talked about the fine staff, he talked about the scientists involved on the stage, and then he said, all those people having the foggiest idea what Dr. Blosser's talking about. Then I knew where I fit into. And I don't. But I'll tell you something about this man. And he and I sat down when I first got elected. And the word I have to use is contagious. His enthusiasm for this project, for his staff, for this university, does overwhelm you and overtake you. And there are, in my opinion, a great many of us Michigan citizens who dwell too much on what is wrong with our state and not all the fine opportunities that are happening every single day. Tonight, and this man is an example of one of them, the building we're standing in and what happened Saturday night is another one. It is my privilege to represent people like Dr. Blosser. It is my privilege to extend to each and every one of you and his staff the sincerest congratulations to the United States government. Thank you very much.
The next speaker is Dr. Harold Hansen, who is the Executive Director of the Committee of Science and Technology in the U.S. House of Representatives. Dr. Hansen.
I'm pleased to have this opportunity to meet with you this evening and to participate in the inauguration of the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. This is a proud moment for Michigan State University and for the scientific community of the nation. As one who has spent a good part of his lifetime as an honest scientist, it's particularly pleasing to me to be part of this celebration. It's my task this evening to discuss the rationale for the federal funding of science. I should say first that I come here as something of a surrogate for Mr. Don Fuquay, the congressman from the 2nd District of Florida, and the man who's chairman of the House Committee on Science and Technology. It is this committee in which Congressman Dunn serves, and those of you from this area should know that Mr. Dunn has been a great representative of the cyclotron and of Michigan State University. It's this committee for which I've been the executive director, and it's this committee which has authorized the funding over the years for the Michigan State program. Mr. Fuquay has gained national prominence as a defender of science and as a champion of research. He has, in fact, been directly useful to Michigan State. He would very much have wanted to have been here for this occasion, but he's busy right now trying to get reelected. I think that those of you who are familiar with what Mr. Fuquay has done for science would agree that it's more important that he be stumping the hustings in Florida than that he be giving a speech in Michigan. I think my own credentials for addressing the topic of the rationale for the federal support of science are reasonable, at least. There's a principle in physics known as the ergodic theorem that says essentially that everything that can possibly happen will happen. What it says in life is that if you've accumulated a sufficient number of gray hairs, you'll have been involved in just about everything that's possible to be involved in. I believe, dealt with every aspect of the federal funding of science, from ladling out to taking it in. So the topic is something about which I've thought a great deal, and it's a topic that I think I know something about. It seems to me that various scientists can and do approach the reality of federal funding from two different philosophical viewpoints. There are those in science who approach the funding problem with a sense of humility. They have a feeling of awe and wonder at the fact that somehow society chooses to pay them and to provide the wherewithal to do exactly the work they want to do. On the other hand, there are those who have a sense of arrogance, who demand that they receive funding simply because they are scientists and are a nature-favored, intellectually endowed group who should be bankrolled to pursue their special interests. Theirs is an ingenuous but invincible conceit. But don't get me wrong. I'm not one of those who decries or deprecates those who are imbued with that special arrogance. They are often, maybe always, the ones who are the most effective fundraisers. In order to get other people to give you their money for your use, you have to ask for it. And this is true whether you're a burglar, a fundraiser for the United Way, or a principal investigator like Henry Blosser. The meek may indeed inherit the earth, but that may be too late. But I hope that some of us at least will continue to marvel at the fact that our leaders in government, acting for a generally uninformed populace, will support the activities of a great scientific institution such as this one. Here at Lansing, at the Michigan State National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory, we have one of the nation's prime examples of how the American taxpayers has generously supported the curiosity of scientists to the tune of thousands, even millions of dollars. This is despite the fact that the American taxpayer himself has little curiosity or even interest in giant resonances or spin-spin coupling. The taxpayer doesn't really care about cross-sections or the relative applicability of the single particle or the collective models. Nevertheless, the taxpayer does fund the research. So it's something of an act of political courage when our political leaders, such as Jim Dunn, who represents and is elected by a general taxpayer, does a politically unpopular thing by voting to spend tax dollars on an activity that is not generally understood or appreciated. Thus, it remains a question that deserves consideration as to why the people collectively do pay us as scientists to give ourselves intellectual excitement and stimulation. There are, of course, answers, sound, convincing answers, although they may be quarreled about in detail. But first, let me outline briefly and somewhat roughly the scope of what we're talking about. This year, the federal government is spending about $40 billion on research and development. That's billion dollars. That's about 5 to 6% of the total federal budget, so it doesn't seem large, but it's a large part of what is possible to spend. Somewhat over half of that is for military R&D, somewhat less than that is for civilian R&D. I won't try to distinguish between basic and applied research, so I'd say that overall a short half of the total R&D budget would qualify as research basic and applied. Now, two things should be borne in mind. First, the expenditure of the federal dollar on science has been and will continue to be large. We have momentum going. The second is that the large expenditures are of rather recent vintage, And while there is momentum, we still have to argue and worry about the increments. World War II marked the beginning of major support for science. Since World War II, science has gone big time. Over $600 billion has been expended. Science now involves virtually every federal department, some 45 congressional committees, a score of specialized agencies, about 500 universities, and nearly 2 million scientists, engineers, and technicians, one-third of them being in research and development. That is the blessing, or perhaps it's the curse, of living in this modern technological era. Now, what justifies this expenditure of tax dollars? In the most fundamental sense, there are two basic reasons for subsidizing scientists to do science. The reasons are simply, one, it's good for our collective bodies, and two, it's good for our collective souls. The ways that research leads to improved physical well-being are fairly obvious if you grant me the fundamental assumption that research, whether directed or undirected, is basic to future development in this complex existence of ours. Once on a time, progress could occur by fortuitous happenstance. We have now reached a point of development that virtually all discoveries will come about by research. Luck and chance will still play a role, but it will be luck and chance in a research laboratory. The most obvious role for the federal government in funding research is in the defense area, and we're spending a lot on that. Actually, about 60% of the federal R&D budget goes to national defense. 8% of that qualifies as pure research, the kind that universities are mainly interested in. Defense research is not something that will be undertaken by universities or industry unless, of course, they are subsidized by the federal government. Since your security and mine depends on the quality of our weaponry, it's clear that it's not only wise for the federal government to fund defense research, it's absolutely imperative. This does not refer only to things like the nuclear bomb and the arcane horrors of biological warfare. It involves conventional weapons as well. The events that transpired in the seas around the Falklands and in the skies over Lebanon demonstrate the necessity for this nation to be prepared for a high-technology modern war with the hope that it will never occur. But not only directed programmatic research is vital to the defense of the nation, we must be heavily involved in the non-directed, unstructured research which may, just may, lead to discoveries that will play a role in the defense of the nation. Clearly, there are other areas of research that the federal government supports that are of material benefit to its citizenry. The Reagan administration is forcing us all to think as to whether such support should not come from sources other than the federal government. It is good and proper for the nation to address that problem. But I don't intend to this evening. I certainly do not quarrel with the administration's philosophy that the federal government should emphasize the long-range and risky research that does not promise an immediate material payoff. I do happen to believe that the vast amounts of money spent by the National Institutes of Health have resulted in even more vast improvements in our abilities to fight diseases. There's probably promise that even greater ability to deal with health problems will come about through federally funded medical research. Similar comments apply to the problem of putting food in our bellies and into the bellies of people around the world. Only through research will we be able to increase further the yield from the land we use presently. Only through research will we be able to use presently sterile soil to yield crops in the future. Only the federal government can mount and support such a research effort. When speaking of the material reasons for having the federal government fund research, it's not infelicitous to point out that supporting federal research does, in many instances, have a purpose that transcends the research itself. The operation becomes a substantial federal project that employs hundreds of workers and has a payroll that qualifies it as a major industry. The large research laboratory has a great and favorable impact on the economy of the community in which it's established. This is true for laboratories within universities. This is a fact which is not lost on congressional representatives from such an area. And as I said, Jim Dunn has been a strong and consistent supporter of the cyclotron. And in that process, he has produced an influx of federal dollars into the Lansing community. One can, in fact, argue that the emergence of the West Coast as an industrial area is due to E.O. Lawrence and his cyclotron. But let's consider some non-material reasons that the federal government should support science. As I see it, the emotional and intellectual justification for governmental support of scientific research involves two main themes. Scientific research addresses man's need for pioneering, his need for new, meaningful challenge, and at the same time, it addresses his need for beauty. Science is an art form and should be nurtured as such. Let me first enlarge on man's need for pioneering and for satisfying his curiosity. Thoughtful scholars such as Frederick Jackson Turner and Walter Prescott Webb have made careers out of pointing out how the existence of the frontier has shaped this nation's destiny and created its self-image. The Western frontier, in addition to offering up its richness in timber and minerals, created a national philosophy of courage, vision, and optimism. Today, the four corners of the spherical earth have been explored, and essentially, man no longer has any geographical frontiers to explore and exploit. One may quarrel a bit about the precise timing of that closure as far as the world is concerned, but the traditional geographic frontier for our nation is gone. That's why it's so important that we face up to the challenge of the two unexplored frontiers that are left to us. We must address them with the same curiosity, courage, and resoluteness that our pioneering and homesteading forefathers addressed the wilderness of North America. The two unexplored frontiers I see are in science and in outer space. I shall not dwell on the space frontier because it's not central to this occasion, but I can't refrain from making the peripheral comment from my experience on Capitol Hill. I have to wonder why the political leadership, both Republican and Democrat, has not in recent years been more aggressive in its support of space research. Our correspondence indicates that the vast majority of our people are enthusiastically and vitally interested in space exploration. But to return to the endless intellectual frontier of science, it's here where society not only stands to reap the material benefits of a new kind of exploration and pioneering, it's here where a nation's pride will be established and its mettle will be tested. As we peel back the layers which reveal the truth of the moment, the problems become harder and harder to tackle. They make greater and greater demands on our nation's intellectual and material resources. This does not mean we should cringe and fall back while pleading our inability to meet the challenge. On the contrary, the times and the difficulties call for renewed scientific effort in keeping with the pioneering traditions of our nation. Man is by nature curious. Pioneering and exploration are curiosity made manifest. Our forefathers wanted to know what was out there in the wilderness, and we too want to know what is out there, whether we're referring to quarks or to black holes or to combining life forms. The natural curiosity of man should not be stifled, and it should be addressed to problems of a grand scale with the consequence of opening vistas also of grand proportions. But there's a second non-material, non-corporeal reason for doing scientific research, other than keeping our courage and our curiosity alive and functioning. Science is an expression of all that is noble in man. You and I know that all individuals involved in creating science are not noble. You and I know that the daily work itself is often commonplace, boring, and tedious. You and I know that the skills of the esoteric studies of high energy physics are often the skills of the plumber and the journeyman electrician and the clerk. But like the hod carrier who recognizes that he is building a cathedral, the scientist, by probing deeper and deeper into the secrets of nature, is erecting a great intellectual edifice that is ultimately a work of art. Man's intelligence and curiosity lead him to a search for understanding. Understanding involves an appreciation for the symmetry and the systematics of nature, and this is beauty at the most fundamental level. I suppose I can sum up what I've been saying as follows. The American public, through their congressional leaders and through their counterparts in the executive branch, has funded here at Michigan State University this large and spectacular and successful and certainly costly journey into the structure of matter. There is good and sufficient justification for this as part of an American thrust into the unknown, which will, without any doubt, contribute to our ultimate well-being as man moves into his future. But let others dwell on the fact that there will be such possible spin-offs as better communications and lower electric bills. Let others emphasize the importance of all this for national pride and national defense and national competitiveness in the international marketplace. Let others focus narrowly on the fact that cross-sections and lifetimes of exotic forms of matter have been and will be observed and measured. Let you and I also rejoice in the fact that man's mind and soul have been uplifted by our participation directly or vicariously in a great intellectual enterprise that has produced and at least partially validated theories that are as beautiful in their own way as a Raphael painting or a Beethoven sonata. Thank you.
I can't help but observe Dr. Hansen is leaving the post in the Committee on Science and Technology to take up the position of provost at Wayne State University. And I think this is a commendable move. Having spent 6 years in that chair, he will move from an organization that is primarily a facilitator and a enabler of jobs to one that is the chief naysayer in most institutions. We wish you well, sir. Our main speaker and last, I would introduce in a moment, but I would caution you beforehand, as we were eating dinner tonight and we were commenting about the hall in which he delivers his lecture, he said, "I've often wondered what an encore for a scientific address was." Dr. Alan Bromley is the Henry Ford Professor at Yale University and will address us on heavy iron science, Gateway to the Unknown. Alan?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, the study of heavy iron phenomena is the most rapidly growing area internationally in nuclear science. And the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory that we meet here to inaugurate brings this nation and this university back to many of its frontiers. The facility that we're joining in inaugurating is going to take us into entirely new domains. It's going to give us access to entirely new science. And if there's one thing I can be sure about, it is that the most interesting, the most exciting, the most important of that science, I will not mention. I will not mention it because I will not know about it. Perhaps none of us will know about it. No nuclear physicist, no physicist, however, can escape the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of the most marvelous year in our history. 1932 was the miracle year in physics, and in particular in nuclear physics. And now I'm told that I'm going to wave my left arm, and this is not because I've developed a strange love tick, but because it's the only way I'm going to get a slide. So we'll try. What happened during 6 months of 1932? The neutron, the positron, and the deuteron were all discovered, opening up whole new fields of science. Heisenberg invented isospin and made theoretical study of nuclei possible. The cyclotron, the Van de Graaff accelerator, the Cockcroft-Walton accelerator were all reported for the first time, making experimental study of the nucleus possible, and beyond that, a myriad of other applications from clinical medicine to the fabrication of circuits that even a year ago would have seemed inconceivable. Accelerator-induced disintegrations were first reported, and in that same 6 months, Kennedy and Thorndike demonstrated that Einstein's special theory was on sound footing, that time was constant, that the velocity of light was constant in all inertial frames. Now, I think that this augurs well for this facility that we inaugurate here. If the next 6 months could be anything like this 6 months, I think we would be rather well pleased. Now, there are many reasons why I'm delighted to have this opportunity to participate in this inauguration. One of them is shown on the next slide. This is the proposal that Hank Blosser mentioned. November 1958 appears up here, and it was prepared by the Department of Physics of this university. There is a mysterious stranger referred to in footnote 82, and Hank has already told you who that is. So it is perhaps not surprising that one third of the justification for this facility was for heavy iron. And I remind you that this was in 1958, at a time when the field had just begun. So now the question was, first of all, why was that so important then? Why is it important now? But before mentioning anything about that, let me simply say that my experience then with Henry Blosser and his associates showed me that when Henry promises performance, he delivers it. And so I think we can, with great confidence, look forward to the behavior of this new facility that we dedicate tonight. Now, back then to heavy ions. Let me have the next slide, please. Here are some of the reasons why heavy ions are important. First of all, we can make the nuclei spin much more rapidly than was ever possible previously. We can stress nuclei with centrifugal forces up to and beyond magnitudes required to make them simply fall apart. Because of the structure of heavy ions, we can have very complicated interactions in which large pieces of nuclear matter are transferred between projectiles and targets. The electromagnetic fields in the vicinity of colliding nuclei are larger than anywhere else in nature, and this gives rise to a whole series of fascinating new phenomena. As you know, Mother Nature, it turns out Mother Nature can spell periodic, but I can't. Mother Nature stopped building elements with a lifetime comparable to the age of the Earth at plutonium. Using heavy ions, we can extend this range. Some of you have heard today of the discovery of the first atom, marvelous experiment at GSI, the first atom of element 109. I will talk briefly in a moment about much heavier systems. And as we smash nuclei into one another, the density increases, and the possibility exists under those circumstances of producing an entirely new kind of matter. We don't know if it's there. We have to find out. In contrast to particle physics, in particle physics, what we've been doing for years is pounding ever more energy into ever smaller volumes to see what happens. In heavy ion physics, the idea is to pound ever-increasing energy into large volumes, large enough to contain many neutrons and protons, so that we have the possibility of collective phenomena. One of the most interesting questions in all of physics today is, what is the nuclear equation of state? How does the nucleus respond to changes of pressure and of temperature? And now we come to applications to other science, to geology, to astronomy, to ultra-fast chemistry, across the whole spectrum of the sciences. In no way